will be the last shiur for our Rebbe series, then we'll go on to something else. We were discussing loans involving corporations, and we mentioned the opinion of Moshe Feinstein. It's really based on an earlier opinion of the Maharshag, Shimon Greenwald, that if there is a corporation that takes a loan, even if that corporation is majority owned by Jews or wholly owned by Jews, since there is a limited liability, this is what Rav Moshe describes as Shibu Nechosim and no Shibu Aguf. This is in Igros Moshe, Chelik Beis Simon Salah Gimel. Only the assets of the corporation are online or on tap for the payment of the debt, but not any of the personal, individuals who are the investors in the corporation. They don't have any personal liability. They don't have any shibud aguf. So therefore, he says that without shibud aguf, you can't have a prohibition of ribis, and all is perfectly fine. Therefore, when a corporation borrows money and pays interest. The distinction between Shibud Aguf and Shibud Nechosim is found in a famous explanation of Rabbeinu Tam as to why it is that if somebody sells a debt, if there's an IOU that's owed to Reuven, then Reuven sells the right to collect that IOU to Shimon, why Reuven still has the right, according to Halacha, to forgive the debt. He sold the debt to somebody else, so the answer is he only sold the Shibud Nechosim, the right to collect the money, but he didn't sell the Shibud Aguf, he didn't sell subordination the original borrower had towards the original lender. That's not something that could be sold. So we see that there's a distinction between Shibud Aguf and Shibud Nechosim. How would it be specifically described in terms of transactional realities? So Moshe says that, let's say there's only Shibud Nechosim. So then a person's assets can presumably be collected for repayment of the loan. But let's say that their assets run out. So do they continue then to have an abiding obligation to pay the loan when they'll come into more money? So he says if there's only Shibud Nechosim, so once the assets are collected, so then the person has no longer any liability. And if the person would end up having more money later on, since there's no liability on the person, but only on their assets, so that would be Shibud Aguf. And since there's no liability, therefore there's no Shibud Aguf. And that type of a transaction would not trigger a ribis prohibition. So we had asked the question last time, okay, Rav Moshe Feinstein wasn't talking about an individual who happens to have pledged certain assets for payment of the loan. He was talking about a corporation. We understand that the corporation has certain assets, and those assets are specifically set aside as the property of the corporation. Somebody loans money to the corporation, they can only collect from the assets of the corporation and not from the individual investors. So the question is, what if I have a non-recourse loan that is not made to a corporation, but it's made to an individual? Do we say a non-recourse loan, let's say, is a mortgage that is extended to an individual, and the mortgage bank, the lender, or maybe the lender is an individual, it's another person, only has the right to collect the property and repayment of the loan. It happens to be a loan with interest, but they can't go beyond the property. If there's a deficiency judgment, they won't have the right to collect the deficiency judgment against the individual. That seems to fit within Rav Moshe Feinstein's description of there not being a Shibud Aguf. So Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, in his book, The Laws of Ribis, says, yeah, of course, Rav Moshe's halacha would apply to a non-recourse loan as well as to anything else. But it's a little curious to me because I didn't come across in my research any explicit discussion of applying Rav Moshe Feinstein, other than that line in Rabbi Reisman's book, to an individual who takes out a non-recourse loan as opposed to a corporation. Although logically, one could presumably extend one to the other. This was a discussion we had last time.
Similar application would be where you have a non-recourse loan to a corporation, but a bad boy carve-out to an individual who's involved with a corporation.
Well, sure. I mean, whenever you have a loan to a corporation, if there's a personal guarantee, for example, that is given by somebody who is Jewish, then that implicates ribis issues. So you would have something similar. But let's say it was non-recourse against that individual, so it would be the same question.
But with respect to only issues like such as fraud or bad faith or anything else, does that make any difference? Meaning that's more, it almost acts as if it's a penalty to, to safeguard against.
It's a general question. Do we say that since there's always the possibility of piercing the corporate veil whenever I have a corporate structure, and
right.
then if you pierce the corporate veil because it turns out that people behave badly, even if you don't have a bad boy clause, it's just the reality, that's the law, you would be able to go after the personal assets of the individuals who intermingled corporate funds with their own funds, for example, and, you know, then you wouldn't have the Shiba Nechasim anymore. So Rabbi Yoshua Weiss discusses that, and he says, okay, for purposes of applying this opinion of Moshe Feinstein, we'll assume that the general state of affairs is that we're not going to come to pierce the corporate veil. That's not going to be something that we're worried about normal course.
So is there anything different
to this opinion
for when you have a guarantor who's in part, part of the, the corporate structure that is, the party to the non-recourse loan? They're fighting a bankruptcy, they're fighting a give back, they're fighting, whatever. That could be the same sort of substance as certain liability, which would be under the corporate being pierced, except it takes a different form.
I think that it makes it worse if you make it explicit. You know, it's with anything. You make it explicit
sure.
that this person is putting themselves on the line with respect to them being liable personally. So then I think that raises the question a little bit more pointedly than if you're just cognizant of the fact that, well, the law in general might allow for the piercing of the corporate veil, but nobody has explicitly contracted that they're going to be liable in that fashion. So the general assumption is you're going to have limited liability. If you're going to explicitly carve out such a guarantee, I would think that would be more problematic. But again, let's say that it's a non-recourse, either with respect to an individual, with respect to a guarantor, an individual borrower, an individual guarantor. It's a non-recourse liability. So again, Rabbi Reisman assumes that Rav Moshe Feinstein's logic would apply even to that case. But I had a hard time locating this. Rav Moshe very clearly is only talking about a corporation. And I decided to dig, a little bit more deeply. I found a few poskim who say explicitly, including the Mishnah Halachas of Menashe Klein, who say the Shail Sechuva Shoal Benishal, who say explicitly that, let's say I have a case where a borrower agrees that they're going to pay principal and interest, but the entire obligation is only going to be paid out of a particular asset. That's what we call a potekim mefurash. A potekim mefurash means lo yedecha piran elamizo, that you only have the right, the lender only has the right to collect from this particular asset. So that's really non-recourse. That's exactly what we're talking about in terms of non-recourse. So they all say, well, of course, ribbis would apply even in such a case, because what is the definition of ribbis? We said ribbis is, if you have a loan which charges interest, that minamalve elalove, right? That's what I have a malve. I have somebody who's lending the money, and I have a love. I have somebody who's borrowing the money. This person is on the line. What difference does it make that this person's obligation is circumscribed by an apotiki mefurish, by a given specifically designated asset? It still has all of the trappings of a regular ribbis transaction. So where did they get this from? Is this true? Is it not true? So the Pnei Yehoshua that points out that this is a Tosfos in Baba Metzia. Tosfos in Baba Metzia and Daftes Baba Mudbeis says explicitly, just kind of like in passing, without giving a long-winded argument about it, just says in passing, yeah, of course, if you have an apotekim beforish, but it's in the context of a loan transaction, that the lender is going to be collecting more than the amount of the original loan, so of course that's going to be ribbis. So the question is, what does Rav Moshe Feinstein do with the apotekim beforish question? So I asked this question of Rabbi J. David Bleich, who's written quite a bit about Hilchos Ribbis and Halacha in the modern-day context, and I said, would Rav Moshe Feinstein apply even to this type of situation? So Rabbi Bleich said Rav Moshe Feinstein couldn't apply in this type of situation because Rav Moshe Feinstein certainly would not have denied this reality that Hilchos Ribbis applies even when there's an apotekim mefurish. So if you have an individual borrower who has a non-recourse loan, then, of course, there would be a ribbis problem according to Rav Moshe, to which I asked, of course, the next bombshell question, which is, well, if that's the case, then how does Rav Moshe Feinstein distinguish between the case of the corporation, where the entire leniency is based on the fact that there's only shibud nechasim, not shibud aguf, and he says that's perfectly fine. In this case, which is your standard personal non-recourse loan, where there clearly appears to be here as well the definition of what Rav Moshe defines as there being shibud nechasim and not shibud aguf, because outside of this particular asset, the lender has no right to collect from the borrower. If the borrower has other assets, or the borrower is going to come into more money sometime in the future. To which Rabbi Bleich responded to me, well, I don't understand Rav Moshe. I don't understand what he says, because, in fact, there is no good answer to that question, and therefore I cannot make sense of why he says with respect to a corporation that it's okay, because he could not possibly extend his logic. And since he could not possibly extend his logic to a personal non-recourse loan, I don't understand how he can apply his logic even to the case of the corporation in the first place. So that was pretty much the gist of my conversation. This raises an important question. We were speaking about Quicken Loans, for example. I just got a call yesterday from another Rav about the whole Quicken Loans question, assuming that this is a lending entity which is wholly or mostly owned by a Jew or Jewish individuals, then it's clearly assuming that there's a problem, as even Rav Moshe indicates. If you have a loan from a corporate entity which is controlled by a Jewish party, there's a whole discussion about that, meaning that there are those who would say that whenever I have a corporate entity, it's really not considered to be a halakhic person altogether. It's just considered to be some legal form, a fictional individual who doesn't have halakhic obligations per se, at least with respect to most monetary dealings, and or ritual law anyway. And therefore, you could argue that even if the malvi, even if the lender is owned by Jews, that you wouldn't have a problem. But lemaisa, that is not the accepted halacha. Even Rav Moshe Feinstein would not accept that and would say, no, if it's mostly owned by Jews, then you're going to have a problem. And others say, well, if the voting, the people who control the decision-making are Jewish, even if they're not majority shareholders, that's what the Minchas Yitzchak says, then you would still have a problem. So we're going to assume that this is a problem. However, so what do you do in that case when you're borrowing from such an entity? So if you have a heter iska, we discuss the mechanics of a heter iska, and you transform the loan into a joint venture agreement, so you solve your problems. But apparently, they don't enter into a heter iska. They don't have an all-encompassing heter iska klali that governs all of their transactions. So I would say, just meet with the principals of this company and try to enter into a heter iska. But assuming that for whatever reason that's not feasible, they're not going to do a heter iska. So then the question was, well, what if you structure the loan with this mortgage company, with this Quicken Loans company, as a non-recourse loan? What if they agree that they're going to make a non-recourse loan and the only asset that they'd be able to collect from it would be the property? So Rabbi Yair Hoffman actually has an article in which he writes about the problems that he envisions with respect to Quicken Loans. Rabbi Yair Hoffman is a Talmid Chacham. He lives in Long Island in New York. And he mentions in passing that Moshe Feinstein's heter, his leniency with respect to corporations, would not apply to this type of a loan, which is to an individual, without further elaboration. But maybe what he was getting at as well is that even if you turned it into a non-recourse loan, it's not at all clear, and it appears that there are proofs that Rav Moshe would not necessarily have extended his leniency with respect to a non-recourse loan. Rav Asher Weiss points out that there's another proof from a Gemara in Bava Metzia Daf Samachay. The Gemara there talks about a conditional sale. Let's say that Reuven sells his property to Shimon and gets money for it. So that's a sale. That's perfectly permissible according to halacha. You can, sell your property and get money. Question whether you sell for too much money. Is there no when you sell real property? Ain't no lakakos. Maybe Tosafot says if you sell for more than double the amount that it was worth, then that's a problem. But assuming that you sell it at a normal price, but Reuven says to Shimon, when Shimon gives him over the money, that I just want to stipulate that in the event that I'm only selling this property because I need the money right now. But in the event that I'm able to get back on my feet and I have enough money to repurchase the property, so we're going to stipulate that I have the ability to repurchase the property from you. So the Gemara says this is not permissible, because what's really going on over here is a loan. That Shimon is loaning money to Reuven. during the time of the loan, Shimon has the ability to enjoy the property rent-free because the property is in Shimon's possession. And as soon as Reuven pays back the money, so then Reuven's going to get his property back. So it's kind of like a mashkon type of situation. And it turns out that the whole thing was a transaction that was founded upon ribbis. So, yes.
Is there a deed or transfer taxes?
I don't know. So Rav, that's the case of the Gemara. So Rav Asher Weiss says that in this particular case, if you think about it, in terms of the lender, you know, who's the lender over here? The lender is Shimon. Shimon pays over the money. So Shimon never has the right to go after Reuven at any point in time and say to Reuven, I demand that you pay the money back. If Reuven never pays the money back, so he just keeps the property forever. Nonetheless, the Gemara says that this is a ribbis problem. So clearly, Shimon has no shibud aguf whatsoever upon Reuven, and nonetheless, the Gemara describes this as ribbis. So therefore, he says that it appears from here as well that the assumption is that you're going to have a ribbis problem as long as you have ribbis haba milove lemalve. That's what the Torah prohibits, as we saw in the Gemara. Lo asa Torah ribbis haba milove lemalve. I have a malve, I have a lova, I have a loan transaction on which the lova is obligated to pay ribbis. So it shouldn't matter whether it's recourse, whether it's non-recourse, shibud aguf, shibud nechasim, you still would potentially have a ribbis problem. So, and even with respect, you know, with respect to corporations, it could be that there's more room for leniency because of the fact that maybe you don't have a malva and a lova. Maybe you're saying that the lova, the individual himself, is not really the borrower. I have some other separate standalone entity, which is considered to be the borrower, like the Rugachev Agon. Rugachev Agon has a tshuva, and there's Shaios Tshuva Siman Kof Pei Dalet, in which he talks about, you know, corporations as being sort of an extension of the concept of Hektesh, of that we had like a temple treasury, which wasn't, you know, owned by any specific person. And the Rugachev says it has a tzura, but it doesn't have chomer. It has a form, but it doesn't have substance. So he says it's just something which form. It's like smoke and mirrors. It just has a form. It doesn't have substance, since it's not like a substantive individual. So therefore, he was prepared to say that ribbis is not applicable to corporations altogether. So at least when you're dealing on the borrower level and you have this additional, you know, argument of saying that we're drawing a clear distinction between the assets of the corporation and the assets of individual investors, so there might be, you know, more to rely upon. When you think about it, it's really a similar svara in that respect when dealing with corporations to that which Moshe Feinstein applied in a slightly different context to explain why he didn't consider it to be a problem when you have when you're borrowing money from, say, a bank, which has certain Jewish investors, but the Jewish investors make up the minority. This is a big question among the poskim. Why don't I have to worry that I'm paying ribbis to the Jewish investors? And some said, well, there's an idea of brera. Brera means that we can try to draw a distinction between different elements of an item and say that it's nigla hadavar, that we are going to consider it to be the reality that you are only taking from certain investors and not from other investors. That if you're borrowing beribis from a bank in which there are loads of investors, so we'll say that there's a brera, that there's like a retroactive designation. Whenever you take a loan from a bank, that you are only borrowing from the non-Jewish investors who would be allowed to loan beribis, as opposed to the Jewish investors who would not be permitted to loan beribis. So others pointed out this is a very weak argument. Why is this a weak argument? Because let's say that there would be liability, that something would go wrong with respect to this loan. So would the Jewish investors of the bank have the right to turn to the non-Jewish investors and say, well, we're off the hook, because after all, it was retroactively determined according to Jewish law that you're the ones who extended the loan. So the answer is absolutely not. They would say, we're all in this together, and we never agreed to this type of retroactive designation. It's the Maram Shik that brings this particular argument against this approach. And there are others who wanted to bring other, you know, arguments and say, well, maybe because the Jewish investors are not directly extending the loan, but it's being done kind of through the office of the bank. So therefore, it's being done through an agent, and then you have Rashi's opinion to rely upon that you don't really have ribbis whenever it's extended by an agent. But we already pointed out, I think, during our first session, that this opinion of Rashi is very, very questionable, la halacha, even though it's brought by the Rama, as the Torah Tamima points out that all that all that you need in order for there to be a ribis problem is that I have a very clearly identified lender and I have a clearly identified borrower. I have the borrower is losing money, he's suffering the neshech. The lender is gaining money, he's getting the tarbis. And, you know, maybe if you're splitting that up and somebody else is losing the money or somebody else is gaining the money who's a third party, so maybe there we can draw distinctions. But otherwise, it really shouldn't matter. If I have a middle person, it's exactly the same result. It's exactly the same form and substance of transaction. So therefore, that's not a good heter. So what really then is the heter when we're dealing with a malva entity, a lender entity, where there are Jews, but the Jews don't make up the majority? So Rav Moshe there says, I think, you know, very cogently, he says that the Jewish owners are not really owners, that because of the fact that they're not the majority of the entity in terms of their ownership, because of the fact that they don't get to dictate policy in any way, therefore, they really just have acquired a right to certain dividends from this company. But you can't really call a person an owner of a company if they don't really have any control over the management and the decision-making and the day-to-day operations of the company. So we understand very well that we can, you know, draw that those types of distinctions when we're talking about the definition of the Jewish or non-Jewish identity, as the case may be, of a corporate entity. But it's much more difficult to draw those same distinctions when we're talking about an individual, when we're talking about a person. So therefore, at the end of the day, it seems that reliance upon this non-recourse argument is very questionable at best. So I just wanted to, you know, start off with that. Now, while we're on the subject, any questions about that? Okay, good. Now, while we're on the subject of, you know, defining the entities, so there's a Rashba that speaks about what if I don't have a bailim yiduim. So the Rashba is quoted in the materials here in source 14. Okay, so take a look at Kosef Rashba b'tshuva. Sha'alta masamfa akshav lahavos mos tamut Torah b'ribis liyisrael. He's asking the question. Apparently, the practice was that they would have yeshiva institutions that would lend money. They would lend money in interest-bearing loans in order for the yeshiva to be able to meet its expenses. This is not a new thing in our generation that yeshivas have, you know, a hard time raising money and meeting budget and so forth. This has been a problem from time immemorial. So the Rashba speaks about it as well. He says, here are the yeshivas. They're supposed to be the paradigms of virtue and our role models, and here they are running around as money lenders and collecting interest money. So he says that maybe the reason is, he says that when is it that you have a malva institution? So we've been speaking about it's a malva institution. It's a corporate entity considered to be a legal person in its own right. Is it defined in terms of the majority owners? So the Rashba gives us a different perspective, which is that maybe that's only a question when I'm dealing with a corporate entity that has clear owners, meaning that there are shareholders. The shareholders get to take dividends when there are profits and things of that variety. But let's say I have a not-for-profit entity where there are no owners altogether. Nobody owns the entity. So if I have an entity where there are no clear owners, there are no bailim yiduim, I have a stock institution, I have a Talmud Torah institution, nobody owns a Talmud Torah. I mean, sometimes you have a Rebbe who owns a shtibel, that's a different story. But if you have your standard yeshiva where nobody actually owns the yeshiva, so then he says that really that wouldn't be a problem of ribis. Why? Because I don't have the situation of malveh and loveh. There is no actual malveh over here. But he says, in roi lasos ken, not a good idea to rely upon this. Why not? Because maybe people will make mistakes. They'll start thinking corporations are okay, when even maybe in situations corporations are not okay. You could see how this type of a leniency could lead to people making mistaken extrapolations. However, he says, however, he says that if the whole purpose is that we're going to extract additional money from people in order to subsidize and to provide scholarships for the Tamidim and these poor children who don't have funds that would otherwise enable them to be in yeshiva and to enable us to feed them and to clothe them and to shelter them and house them. So then he says everybody has this mitzvah stuck anyway, so you could be more lenient in this case. Now, the Beis Yosef points out that the Rashba also speaks about this in another tshuva as well. And the final line, the punchline of this other tshuva, where he's talking about Moshe Hekdei Shaniyim and so forth, the punchline is, the punchline is that even with this consideration of Bailam She'enim Yiduim, the Rashba really, at the end of the day, at least in a different tshuva, either, as we saw in this tshuva, he figures out a way not to define it as ribis, it's just kind of pushing people to perform their tzedakah obligation anyway. Or the Rashba says in a different tshuva that really we would not allow this with respect to ribis de araisa, but only with respect to ribis de rabbanan. And that's consistent with the Gemara in Baba Metzia, which is codified in the Shulchan Aruch. That's source 12 over here in Siman Kuf Samach Sif Yutes, which is called ribis de rabbanan. It's based on a Gemara that allowed the lending of money that belonged to orphans, which is money needed to help support the orphans, so it's for mitzvah purposes. So it allowed the lending of that money in a fashion which constituted only ribis d'rabbanan, only rabbinically prohibited ribis. So the Shulchan Aruch expands this to not only Moshe Yisomim, but to any kind of Talmud Torah, Tzorach Beis HaKnesis, and so forth. So we see that we have a different hetzer built in when the ribis is for some sort of a stock institution where at the very least we will allow ribis to rabbanon. And one of the considerations as to why ribis to rabbanon is permissible, or we're prepared to stretch the envelope a little bit, is because of the fact that we're often talking about an institution where we have bialim she'enim yudum. Remember that Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was prepared on that basis to say that Israeli bonds shouldn't even require a heter iska because there are no bialim yudum. Nobody owns the government, right? Since nobody owns the government, so he felt that's even better than your regular case of corporation. Something's worse. Something that Israeli bonds are worse because, what do you mean nobody owns the government? Everybody owns the government. That the entire citizenship of Israel are all considered to be partners in the government. That's the way that a democratic government works. It's a government by the people, for the people, of the people, right? Either way, in Eretz Yisrael, they actually have a heter iska for the Israeli bonds, so you don't have to worry about it. But these are the types of considerations that come into play. The notion, though, that in general, when I'm dealing with Moshe, you're someone dealing with tzedakah matters, tzedakah institutions, ribis d'rabbanan is permissible, so that allows leeway with respect to a variety of other areas. Because we already pointed out that a lot of hilchos ribis falls into the category of ribis d'rabbanan, rabbinically prohibited ribis. Like, for example, mekach u'memka, whenever there's any kind of a transaction where it's not originally a loan, it's just a sale, you allow, for example, you say that a person's going to pay extra if the money is paid in installments, for example. So that's only ribis d'rabbanan. On the flip side of the equation, if you buy something and you prepay for it, and there's a discount when you prepay for it, so that's ribis d'rabbanan on the other side of the equation, because the person who's prepaying the discount is considered to be extending a loan to the vendor, and then the vendor gives them an item that's worth more than the money that they put down because there was a discounted amount as a result of having had the use of the funds for an extended period of time. So discounts are also problematic, but they're only problematic on a d'rabbanan level. So if you had some sort of like an event, or you had some sort of a service that a synagogue was extending and they were providing prepayment discounts, so that's a problem when you're in commerce, when you're representing a client who's in real business. So prepayment discounts are very, very problematic unless, there are certain special factors in place that would allow leniency, such as that the product's only being provided later, but it's really available right now, or something like that. We call yeshlo. But if you're dealing with a tzedakah institution, so then it's useful to know that these types of things that would only constitute ribis d'rabbanan would be permissible. So example of this, where the question of what constitutes ribis d'rabbanan really becomes applicable when dealing with, say, yeshiva institutions and the like, is if the yeshiva is providing a loan to somebody. It could be sometimes the yeshiva provides somebody with a scholarship, but sometimes yeshivas provide loans. This is especially true. I worked for a number of years as a menahel at Yeshiva University. So Yeshiva University provides student loans. This is part of what they do. Student loans are not interest-free propositions. Student loans require repayment with interest. So what would give them the right to provide a student loan with a repayment of interest? So you'll say, okay, well, it's a it's a Tamma Torah institution. Here you have to ask the question, what if the person goes to the law school? Does that really still count, Tamma Torah institution? Torah Mada, how do you understand Mada? Is that part of Torah or not? Okay, all these chakiras come into play. So the question then becomes, how does it become only Ribbis the Rabbanon? So Rav Shechter, Rav Herschel Shechter Shlita, had a chiddush that he thought that stock institutions could rely upon a certain comment of the Bris Yehuda. The Bris Yehuda, as I mentioned, was one of the first Sfarim, first contemporary Sfarim, written as a restatement, so to speak, of Hilchos Ribbis. All of the subsequent Sfarim really took off on the Bris Yehuda. Bris Yehuda points out there's a Tosfos in Ksuvos. The Tosfos in Ksuvos, Daf Mem Bavim and Aleph, notes that if you look at the psukim that describe ribbis, so it says neshech kesef, neshech ochel, neshech odavar shir tishach. It's referring to things like food and money, and then there's a generalization, a kodavar shir tishach. But Tosu says it has to be like food and money. It has to be metaltalin, things that are movable. It doesn't have to be davka money. It doesn't only have to be money. It could be objects that you're loaning, but it has to be movable objects. So, for example, so Tosu says mechadish, ribbis doesn't apply to karka. At least on a Daraisa level, ribbis would not apply to karka, would not apply to real estate. So the Ran, in his recapitulation of a Tosfos, in his commentary on the Rev, so he says, yeah, so it wouldn't apply to karka. And of course, it wouldn't apply to shtaros either, because shtaros, as we know, they always go, whenever we exclude karka, we often exclude shtaros, that karka is not metaltalin, and shtaros are not gufo mamon. If I'm talking about kesef and okel, those are things which are movable and they are intrinsically worth a value, a monetary value, as opposed to a shtar, an IOU note or something, a promissory note, does not have intrinsic value. It only gives somebody the ability to be able to obtain value by collecting money. So it's not considered to be gufo mamon. So the Ran says, so anything which is not gufo mamon, any shtar, an IOU, something like that, would not constitute a ribbis de araisa if you loaned in that particular fashion.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the case. When you say it doesn't apply to karka, it doesn't apply to shtars, what does that mean?
So if somebody would loan karka and say, I'm giving you karka and you have to give me back the same amount of karka plus more karka. So that would be...
I loan you one building and you
have
to...
Right, I'm giving you an IOU for this amount, you got to give me back an IOU for a larger amount.
So the shtars case is like, I'm giving you like some contract that gives you a right to collect something.
Right.
And you have to pay me back with
a bigger contract. That's right.
Okay.
Something along those lines. So it's a good question, though, because there's a discussion about exactly what it means. So the Bris Yehuda says, you know what it means? We know how it would be applicable in modern-day commerce. It would apply to checks. So he says, so a check is not considered to be goofy mammon. Well, piece of paper entitles you to collect something. So that's not goofy mammon. That doesn't have any intrinsic value. So he says, therefore, if somebody would loan money with a check, say you give somebody a check for $200, say, okay, I'm loaning you this $200, and I want you to repay me $250 with a check. So since everything is being done with checks, so therefore that wouldn't be ribbis d'oraisa. So Shachter says, okay, well, based on this, then this was a comment that he made 30 years ago. He says, 30 years ago, there was such a thing as checks. So people would loan money, borrow money, pay for things. So they would take out their checkbook and they would pay with checks. So he said, people are going to borrow money anyway. They're going to borrow money with the checks. So whenever they're going to repay the money, they're going to repay the money with a check. Everything is a check, so therefore it's ribbis d'rabbanan. So nowadays, it's much more difficult. First of all, this is a question as to whether this is really the halacha, because the Tosfos is not necessarily agreed upon by everybody. The Ran's addition to Tosfos is not agreed upon by everybody. Neither the opinion of Tosfos nor the opinion of the Ran is recorded in Shulchan Aruch. So it's a big stretch to get to the point where we would accept that shtaros are only ribbis d'rabbanan, and to get to the next step to say that checks function in such a way that they're considered to be like a shtar. Maybe they're more than a shtar. Maybe a check is considered to actually have more monetary value in terms of what you could do with a check as opposed to an IOU, which you pull out in order to try to extract money from somebody, but it's not like an automatic thing. You slip it into to the teller and you presto, you get the money back. So it's not necessarily the case that everybody would agree that a check is not gufo mamon. But even with all of that, nowadays, it's just not the reality anymore. Nowadays, the facts on the ground is that people are not paying with checks. So then the question is, so how is money being transferred? Money is being transferred generally just with giving the value of merchandise. Like if it's a student loan that's given by the institution, so then it's simply in the form of enabling the student to benefit from the school without having to pay up right away. Or if it's in your usual type of transaction, when money is transferred, it's going to be wired in many, many cases. In most big transactions nowadays, it's wired. The question is, how do we understand a wiring of money? A wiring of money generally entitles the person to just, you know, collect money right away. It's not a shtar per se. It's just a convenient way of, without having to actually physically hand over the money, it's considered like you're handing over the money. Wiring seems to be much more in the realm of gufa mamon. So I once upon a time asked Rabbi Bleich about this question as well. What type of allowance might you have with respect to student loans? When I was at Yeshiva, we actually formulated a heter iska. That was one of the things that I did when I got there, was to put together a heter iska, and it's available for anybody who wants to use it in the general counsel's office. Ad hayom hazeh, you have students who want to take out student loans to do it with a heter iska, so there is a nusach of heter iska that can be utilized. But there is an argument, Rabbi Bleich said, as to why you can still argue that a student loan would be ribbis to a bond, because he said what is really going on with respect to the interest of a student loan, it's like a commercial transaction. He says, mekach u'memkar, a service is being provided. What's the service that's being provided? The education is being provided. And what is the school really saying when it's extending the loan? It's not really giving any money whatsoever. It's just saying, we're providing the service, this mekach, we're providing to you, and instead of paying us now, you would have to pay whatever is the set amount of tuition. We'll let you pay out over time, only you're going to have to pay more. So that would be just so that would be ribbis in a mekach u'memkar context. Since it's in a mekach u'memkar context, where a person's receiving a service, they're just allowed to pay for the service later on, provided that they pay more money. So therefore, that's not ribbis d'oraisa. It's not really in the form of a loan. It's ribbis d'rabbanan. The real question for that is that the way in which it is at least memorialized is in the form of loan documentation. It would be much better then, if that's going to be the argument, and instead of the documentation being loan documentation, it should be some sort of a contractual documentation which says, we hereby agree to furnish services of schooling and of dormitory services and whatever else towards you for this period of time. However, in lieu of your having to pay upfront, if you pay at a later point in time, then you'll have to pay in the following installments based on the following rate to compensate for the fact that you're not paying up front. But that really should be nature of the contractual documentation between the parties if we're really trying to get it down to ribbis to a button on that basis. Form is very, very important because we know that unlike with respect to other isurim in the Torah, ribbis, it's a whole discussion in the Gemara, whether ribbis is, whether shuma is usur, whether the mere contracting for the ribbis obligation before it's paid is prohibited. And we generally assume, according to most poskim, that we paskin, like that shuma is usur, that even the mere stipulation, what we call the kitsitsa of a ribbis, the providing for the ribbis obligation between the lender and the borrower, constitutes a violation of los simun alav neshech, of placing neshech, of placing ribbis upon somebody even from the outset of the transaction. So therefore, the form in which the transaction is memorialized is actually very important in terms of whether or not there's going to be a prohibition in place. Now, one of the big questions then is that we've mentioned that one way in which we get out of our iska problems, one way we get out of the ribbis problems is through heter iska. So the heter iska, in order to really be effective as a matter of halacha, it needs to be something that is real. If it's not real, so then you still are left with a ribbis transaction. So the question is, how does it really work, bizman hazeh, when you have the loan documents that are all prepared in accordance with secular law, and then it's like you're just placing this incantation, you're placing this hocus-pocus religious formula upon it, and saying, oh, everything is api heter iska, everything is done according to heter iska, and suddenly everything becomes okay. So that's a real question, la halacha, as to whether that's good enough. So most of the poskim and the Bris Yehuda discusses this, say that you have to make sure that the heter iska is at least effective according to halacha, that halachically it could be enforceable, that in the event it would be proven by witnesses and taking an oath that there were real losses in the investment or all of the borrower's investments, as the case may be, and that there weren't the profits that were anticipated, that there has to be a possibility that the borrower will not have to pay the amount of the loan. Because if there really is no possibility whatsoever that the borrower could get out of it, then you really have a problem from a halakhic perspective. How do you navigate that? So what I tell people is that the heter iska document, at the very least, has to include a bezdin clause in it that says that if either of the party wishes to enforce this contract or any disputes regarding the enforceability or the terms and conditions of this document, we agree to submit any such dispute to the binding adjudication of the following bezdin, that you have the ability to bring it into rabbinical court. And then at least we know that there's a rabbinical court jurisdiction over the heter iska, that it could theoretically be enforced. Now, technically speaking, all the loan documents should say that if there's a dispute that the place, if it's between two Jewish parties, that the dispute would be brought to in front of a bezdin. The fortunate thing is, though, that let's say that you're a borrower in a transaction and you want to make sure that you are abiding by all of the requirements of halacha. So as long as you have a heter iska in place, then you're avoiding the problem of having a ribbis transaction, which is prohibited according to Jewish law, because if you would have a stipulation that the loan is going to be paid with interest, even if you get out of it at the end, you've already committed a violation at the time that you made this stipulation. However, when it comes to the prohibition of going to civil courts, there is no prohibition per se until the parties have actually gone to civil court. So let's say you enter into a transaction with somebody, another Jewish person, and you want the contract to say that, of course, if there's ever a dispute, we'll go to Bezdin. But the other person says, no, I'm not so observant, and I don't believe in that. I only want to enforce my contract in a civil court. And therefore, that person wants to put that provision in the contract. You have to walk away from the contract. You don't have to walk away from the contract. Because you still have in mind that you hope the person will do tshuva if it ever came to the case being needing to be litigated, and you're still prepared to litigate the case in Bezdin if need be. Just this person wants to put into the contract that they want to go to a civil court, so they can do so, or if they do so, you don't have to necessarily stop them. And maybe that'll make it easier for you to have a heter to go to civil court if you need to bring a claim against them and the Bezdin needs to determine that this is somebody who refuses to go to Bezdin, in which case they can always give a heter or a kos. But there's no violation per se if you're not, you know, planning to go to if you're not planning to go to civil court, because at any point in time, parties can opt out of such a contract and agree that they're going to arbitrate their disputes in front of a Bezdin. So therefore, if the loan documents have that clause, then that would not invalidate the entirety of the transaction. It wouldn't constitute a prohibition per se. Then it would just end up being essentially a race to, you know, the courthouse, that you have the heter iska document that says that the heter iska can be adjudicated in Bezdin. If the other documentation says that the parties can go to a civil court, so it could be whoever will, you know, jump, you know, first to go there, to go to one or other of the venues that might have the ability to do so. But at least theoretically, the borrower has the ability, based on the terms and stipulations of the heter iska, to bring an action, even an action that would be enforceable by civil law, to bring an action to Bezdin. This is a little bit of a chiddush, but if you look at the poskim, it appears that, you know, this could still work. I'm not advocating this. I think that the loan documents as well should say that they should go to a Bezdin. The other problem with the loan documents, though, is that the loan documents really make it sound like a loan. So that's the question. What is it, really, from the standpoint of secular law? So here, there's a very important insight. What we describe as a joint venture is not a joint venture according to civil law. If it would be a joint venture according to civil law, so then the person who is loaning the money, what we call the investing partner, the person who's the malve, for all, you know, intents and purposes from a secular law perspective, that person, if they were really engaged in a joint venture, they wouldn't only be on the hook for the money that they are lending, that, you know, maybe they'll lose their entire investment, or according to halach, it's a chatzi milva chatzi pikadon, they might lose, you know, no more than half of their investment. But if there were liabilities that were incurred by the managing partner, so then the lending partner would, as a joint venturer, as a partner in the enterprise, would have all kinds of liabilities, well beyond the amount of money that was extended for the purpose of the loan. But that's not consistent with halacha. That's not what we mean when we say joint venture. So therefore, it's very, very important to have different terminology to make it very clear. It's not inconsistent with halacha to make it very clear, even if the loan documents say nothing herein shall cause this transaction to be construed as a partnership or joint venture, that's not a contradiction to the halakhic terms of the transaction. Because when we say joint venture in the Heter Iska document, we don't mean the same thing that they mean from a secular perspective when they say joint venture, which is why I've always very strongly advocated that the Heter Iska forms that are utilized should have a very, very bold and clear legend on the top of the form. I think we have this in the materials, which says, even if it's not, or at least half of the document has the introduction, as you see, where it says, Jewish religious law strictly prohibits paying or receiving of interest on loans, and therefore, when there's a business transaction, we make a partnership according to Jewish law in order that it is then considered to be profit rather than interest on a loan. But you have some sort of a legend that makes it clear, that begins with the words Jewish religious law, that this is being done for Jewish religious law purposes. It doesn't mean that it's hocus pocus or what we would call a chukah bitlula. What it means is that any terms that are utilized in our characterization of the document are only really terms that make sense from the standpoint of halakha, of Jewish religious law, as opposed to from the standpoint of secular law. It's perfectly fine if from the standpoint of secular law, they view this as a loan, because that's not a contradiction to our halakhic viewing of the transaction. Yes, it's a loan. Maybe from their perspective, we have the ability to get out of the repayment if we can prove that there were losses on the investment. But for their purposes, in terms of the respective liabilities and responsibilities of the parties in the normal course, it still is consistent with regular loan documentation. And therefore, you can really have the two existing side by side. The one thing, though, that I think is important is that it shouldn't only be in the Iska, although the poskim like Minchas Yitzchak indicate that it's not the end of the world, but it seems to me that it's better if the reference to the Shtar Iska doesn't only exist in a standalone Iska form that never gets filed together with the other closing documents of a transaction, but that the actual documents in the transaction make reference to the fact that there is a Heter Iska. And then what do the courts do with it? If there really is, like, let's say there was a case just a few years ago where there was a Jewish bank that extended a loan and they had a Heter Iska in place, a Heter Iska Klali or something like that, or they made reference to a Heter Iska in the loan documents, and then that bank assigned the loan to another bank, and the borrower in the meantime had a loss on the transaction. It was a mortgage, and the property went bad, and it was clear that was the nature of the investment. So that they had proof positive that the investment went sour, and therefore they did not want to have to pay the deficiency judgment, and they brought to court. This is a case called Lindbergh. It's a BND versus Lindbergh, something like that, from a few years ago. And the borrower brought the Heter Iska as a defense that they shouldn't have to pay the deficiency judgment. So interestingly there, the court said, well, we don't see the Heter Iska. It didn't have the terms of the Heter Iska, so it couldn't really iron out whether the Heter Iska would allow the borrower to make that defense. Remember, Api halakha, the borrower really couldn't make that defense if the Heter Iska meant that the borrower was bringing the lender in as a joint venture in all of the borrower's investments, because then even if the house investment went bad, it could be that the lender would still be entitled to money if there were other investments of the borrower that were perfectly okay. The court didn't have the sophistication to discuss all of this, but the court said, well, if you look at the loan document says that everything is going to be governed according to New York law. According to New York law, we have a regular loan transaction, regular mortgage transaction in place that would entitle the mortgagee to the collection of deficiency judgments. So therefore, we're not going to look any further. But that's a real question as to how the banks are going to view the Heter Iskas. The doctor, Professor Stephen Resnikoff, has a very learned essay on this particular topic that he published in one of the law journals. But the bottom line is that it's very important, number one, to make sure that it's real in terms of there being some sort of bezdin enforceability, but number two, also to make sure that the characterization of the loan for Jewish law purposes is clearly distinguished from the way in which it might be viewed from secular law purposes, so that there are not any unwanted or unintended adverse consequences that would result as a result of a misinterpretation of what we mean when we speak about this being a joint venture.
So
it was yes.
We assume that the courts would do like they did in the case you just mentioned, that they would say the heteriska just has no effect. So would that basically render it useless unless you include language that would avoid that effect?
Right. You know, the Rabbi Bleich writes that as long as the documents indicate that they can be enforced in Bezdin, heteriska can be enforced in Bezdin, it's good enough. Then if one party goes to civil court, then from the perspective of the civil court adjudication, you could just put the heteriska out the window, because that's if they decide they're going to lose out on the parties decide that they're going to lose out on the benefits of the heteriska by going to court, so kind of like that's their own problem. It's not going to change or affect the status of the transaction from a secular law perspective. So he says, so they write that for purposes of any secular adjudication, the heteriska shall be ignored. That's the way he
and
puts it.
Fine, as long as
he says it's fine as long as you have the ability to enforce it in Bezdin.
Like
he says that's fine.
You can go to Bezdin and get your money back, get a refund on the court judgment?
In theory, you should be able to do so. If you really couldn't do so, you'd have a problem. I remember it was some lawyer once saying to me that if you have a usurious loan, that's usurious according to American law, so then you're much better off in Bezdin than you are in secular court. But if you have just a regular usurious loan, that it would be below the threshold of what's considered to be, you know, not allowable in American court, so then you would be better, assuming you want to violate halacha, you'd be better if you were in secular court than if you were in Bezdin. Because there is actually a threshold on usury in American law that you can't charge more than, it used to be 16%, and if it's more than 16%, then you don't have the right to collect it. If it's something like 24%, so it's considered to be criminal usury, people could be put into jail, can suffer criminal penalties. So there was a case called Labor Wiki versus Wiki, I think it's in the materials. Yeah, that's source number 18, where there was a loan between two Jewish parties. There was a heter iska in place, and the rate of usury was more than the civil law statute would have allowed. Now, under American law, what happens if you violate the civil law statute against usury? You can't collect the usury. You know what else you can't collect? You can't collect the principal either. According to halacha, if you have a usurious loan and you isolate in the contract which part is principal and which part is ribis, which part is interest, so can you collect the interest? No, but can you collect the principal? Yes, you can collect the principal. So therefore, the argument was, you're better off in Bezdin, because at least Bezdin will allow you to collect the principal, while in secular court, you won't be able to collect the principal or the interest. So I pointed out to this lawyer that it's not necessarily the case, because laws of usury are considered to be within the public policy exception of the jurisdiction of arbitration tribunals. That when an arbitration tribunal hears the case, they have wide latitude to decide however they want, unless it's in contravention of public policy. There's certain things which are considered to be areas of very, very strict public policy. Even an arbitration tribunal is not able to issue an enforceable award if it thwarts public policy. And usury is generally viewed as one of those areas where there's a strong public policy concern on the part of the court system. And therefore, an arbitration tribunal would presumably not be able to issue an enforceable judgment to allow somebody to collect the principal if, under secular law, their usurious statutes have been violated. So it's not entirely clear that even a Bezdin in that particular case, based on Dina de Malchusa Dina, would be able to enforce the collection of the principal. And as far as the case where you have regular interest, well, it depends on whether you have a heter iska. If you have a heter iska, in effect, you might actually be better off when you have a usurious transaction. According to secular law, it turns out that even if it would otherwise be a ribis-bearing transaction, well, this person said, the person would be better off in Bezdin than they would be in secular court. Once you throw in the heter iska, the secular courts might say that this is actually makshir, this actually does away with the problems that would otherwise exist with respect to ribis. Because what happened in the Labor Vicki case, very, very fascinating decision on the part of the court. They said, since there is, when it comes to usury laws in New York State, usury laws require the intent to enter into a usurious transaction. But since over here they entered into a heter iska, which shows that their intent was to create some sort of a Jewish law ritualistic joint venture. However we would understand that joint venture, it shows that there was not usurious intent. Since there was not usurious intent, therefore, both the principal and the interest could be collected in that particular case. So the court was very, very generous with respect to its interpretation of the clause. Maybe the Bezdin wouldn't have been as considerate of the parties, because it could be that the Bezdin would have found some defect in the heter iska for all we know. So therefore, I told the lawyer that it's not necessarily the case that this bifurcation between cases where there's American law usury or not should dictate exactly where parties would end up doing better off. But obviously, according to halakha, the parties are always supposed to end up in the Bezdin. There was another case called called Bolag versus Dresden. It was a 1985 case in which the parties had a usurious clause. I don't think I have it in the materials over here, but where there was a usurious clause, and the court came to the conclusion that because the whole reason there was a heter iska, but the heter iska, and it was a very, 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 very high amount of interest in that case. I think even more than the Labor Vicki case. It was 24% interest in that case. And the court came to the conclusion that since the parties testified that they entered into the heter iska because nobody would ever want to collect interest according to Jewish law, so he said, so we see that the plaintiff in the case, who was the creditor who wanted to collect the 24% interest, says explicitly he entered into the heter iska because he wouldn't want to collect prohibited interest, so therefore I'll do him a favor and I'll say you can only collect the principal and you can't collect the interest. So the courts are very, very unpredictable when it comes to these cases. That was the decision in that particular case. But you see that the more in which the form is indicates that there is a only a Jewish law purpose to having the heter iska, it can work for us, but at the same time provide for some sort of protection against the secular law interpretations. You have that in the source 17 with the Heimbinder case and the Arnav case, where the people where various parties were trying to argue that there were liabilities that went far and beyond what would be in a normal loan transaction, such as creating a joint tenancy. And because the document said nothing herein is intended to create a joint venture, partnership, tenancy in common, or where there were indications that the document was merely a compliance in form with Hebraic law, that helped out for halakhic purposes. So I'd just like to conclude by identifying one other area where these laws come into play, bisman hazeh, and that's with respect to currency exchanges. We pointed out that when it comes to currency exchanges, any currency which is not the currency of the place that you live is viewed as a commodity as opposed to money. So therefore, that creates ribbis problems if you're going to loan even, say, British pounds in America to receive British pounds in return. One place, because maybe they'll be worth more monetarily at the time in which they return. The only time that you could do that is if you have the sa'ab sa'ah dispensation, that the borrower has some of this commodity in their possession at the time in which they take out the loan. One area where this occurs is, and this could occur in all kinds of international transactions where you're dealing with other currencies. It was discussed by the poskim in the context of Eretz Yisrael, when there was shkolim that were loaned and people wanted to get dollars in returns. The whole question there is whether dollars are also considered to be monetary currency in Eretz Yisrael. Now that the shekel is stronger, there's less of an argument to make today that it's considered to be acceptable currency or legal tender the way that it was, say, 30 years ago when inflation in Eretz Yisrael was amok and the only stable type of currency was the dollar, where that was a totally different story. So they give two different approaches, and this is very important, of how one can make this type of thing work. One is called hatsmada, that's called linking. Linkage is like this. A person makes a loan of shkolim, and they say that we're going to link it to what the dollar is worth today, and then when the money gets paid back in the end, it's going to get paid back in dollars. That only works if dollars would be considered to be legal currency. So that's one form, which is called linkage. And then, according to some postkin, once you've linked it, as long as the dollars are available to pay on the day that everything becomes due, you can also convert those dollars to shkolim. So it'll turn out a person gave 500 shkolim and got back, 700 shkolim, and it's all considered to be legal according to those postkim. It's a matter of controversy. The way in which is less controversial, where you don't require the dollars to be legal tender, and this is relevant, again, from for lawyers who deal with different currencies, is if you make it into a psika, you make it into a sale, like a prepayment discount sale. You say that I am paying shkolim today to acquire dollars from you tomorrow. That I'm giving you a certain amount of shkolim, and in return for the shkolim, you're going to pay me with the dollars. The only thing is that I'm giving you a discount because I'm buying the dollars. It's not a loan. I'm doing it in the form of a sale. And if the form of the transaction, the documents reflect that it's not a loan, but rather it's a sale, I'm buying dollars from you by virtue of putting down shkolim, so that actually works. The only condition is that the person who is borrowing the money, since it's a prepayment discount, prepayment discounts only work when yeshlo. It means that the person who is receiving the money, the person who is receiving the shkolim originally, would have to have all of those dollars, would have to have that quantity of dollars that they are now promising to pay, that would already have to be in their possession at the time of the payment of the shkolim in order for that to work. But that could work. That's called psika. And to the extent that lawyers are dealing with, say, cross-currency, different types of transactions, that's one way to turn it from a loan into a prepayment discount transaction that you can make it work out via halacha. So I give everybody a bracha. We should all, you know, figure out how to arrange all of our transactions for ourselves and our clients. I'll be halacha that there shouldn't be any violations of the laws of ribis or any other halachas. Mm-hmm. Any questions?
Where's two more guys?
Okay, all right. Okay, unfortunately, we don't have enough for a mincha, but we'll continue with a new topic next time.